Today's Taisho will be on case 38 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 38 is entitled, A Buffalo Passes the Window. Gozo said, a buffalo passes by the window. His head, horns, and four legs all go past. Why can't the tail pass too? Mumon's comment. If you make a complete about face, open your eye and give a turning word on this point, you will be able to repay the four kinds of love that have favored you and help sentient beings in the three realms who follow you. If you are still unable to do this, return to this tale and reflect upon it, and then for the first time you may realize something. Mumon's verse, passing by it falls into a ditch, coming back all the worse it is lost, this tiny little tale, what a strange thing it is. For those of you who might be here for the first time, I'd like to explain that this is what we call a koan in Zen. A koan is from the word koan is a Chinese, goes to a Chinese root, which is a word something like gung an. I'm sure that's not correct, but Koan, Gung An. Gung An is a case in law. In Chinese law, Gung An is a case. So these are cases in Zen. And these cases are used for the training of Zen students. The way a koan works is as follows. A person begins Zen practice by learning how to sit properly on the cushion. This means arranging the body in the appropriate way, and by arranging the body in the appropriate way, we make it possible for the mind to enter an appropriate state of concentration. So we sit on a cushion with the back straight, and we learn to breathe through the dantian or hara, the region around the navel. And generally, in our tradition, people are asked to focus their minds on their exhalations. In Zen, this is known as breath perception meditation. So you watch the breath, and you watch the breath, and you watch the breath, and little by little, you undergo a significant psychological transformation. Human beings are actually capable of entering many different states of mind. Although we ordinarily spend our lives in a rather small number of those states, we have available to us many other states which are quite wonderful. One of these states is referred to in Zen as samadhi. And by samadhi, we in Zen mean a state of meditative concentration in which the split between the self and the world disappears. Often this is accompanied by sensations like floating, expanding, hands or face disappearing. You might feel that you're turning around on your cushion or twisting even though you're straight. These are physical sensations that often accompany entry into samadhi. In the samadhi state, we are no longer separate from the world around us, to the same degree that we are in ordinary consciousness. And experiencing the moment is much more direct and less obstructed by thought, feeling, and so on. In samadhi, you are really at the first step of Zen practice. And then after that, the teacher gives you koans, these subjects for meditation. In our tradition, the first koan after the breath meditation koan is called the mu koan. And that's quite important and difficult. It takes a number of years to work through. And then after that, the teacher will give you a series of koans, and one at a time. And it usually takes months or years to work through a koan. Now, a koan usually involves a story, and it can be a very simple story. In this case, it could hardly be more simple. Goso, who is a Zen master, poses a question to a student. We don't really know to whom he poses the question, but it's just Goso said, and here's the question. A buffalo passes by the window, his head, horns, and four legs all go past. Why can't the tail pass too? So it could hardly be more simple, little story. And the purpose or the appropriate use of a koan is this. You enter deep samadhi, and then you begin to internalize the koan. So in a state of deep samadhi, you begin to say, some phrase that's part of the koan, and that's called the turning phrase or the turning word. In this case, the turning word would probably be, a turning phrase would probably be can't pass, can't pass, can't pass. And koans sometimes have an intellectual character to them, right? I mean, this is a question about buffalo passing a moon gate. And you could interpret it as in various ways. So it has a kind of intellectual character. But it's quite important to understand that the koan is not supposed to be worked through intellectually. It has to be worked through on a deeper psychological level. And in this way, Zen practice gradually removes the obstacles to awakening. This is the function of the koan. So when I deliver talks on Zen practice, it's possible to think that I'm giving offering food for thought, or lessons for life, or moral instruction, or fables about this and that. But all of that would be incorrect, actually. You know, the function of a talk like this is simply to say, please do some zazen. And you can say that in a million different ways. And also, in a way, this is like preparing the ground for future practice. Because we've all come here today and we've been sitting in samadhi, more or less deep. And I'm going to talk and drone on for an hour. And you'll probably sit there focusing on your breath. And this is ideal, right? And the things I say may or may not seem very significant. They may pass quickly by. But this is like preparing the ground. So later, when we do this koan together, you know, already it may have a kind of special resonance or special importance. Also, if you're sitting in samadhi, this may resonate on a deeper level, even though it seems to have very little intellectual intellectual depth or substance. So the function of a koan is often misunderstood. You know, these are not ethical treatises. It's not philosophy. It's not lessons for life. Really not what this is about. It's really saying, please practice more deeply. And so it's not exactly quite like a lecture that you might have in class. And it's not exactly like a sermon. Because, you know, people who go to hear sermons are not sitting in deep samadhi, generally speaking. So different format and different kind of discourse, and it has a different function. You might say that when we're in deep samadhi listening to the Taisho, Taisho is sort of the language of the unconscious, or approaches the language of the unconscious. So it's not really a coherent sort of talk. Especially mine are not very coherent. But generally speaking, they're not coherent. They aren't laid out in a certain form, and there aren't supposed to be any lecture notes or anything like that. The person speaking is supposed to enter deep samadhi and work with the koan, and whatever comes out is okay. It requires great trust in the process. So I just wanted to explain what we're up to today, because it's easily misunderstood. Hopefully, I hope that we'll all have a chance to work with this koan someday. What happens is that the teacher will give you a koan, and you'll work with that koan, and usually the koan strikes some kind of a deep chord sooner or later inside yourself. Maybe this koan will strike a deep chord with you today, maybe not. But sooner or later, if you work with this koan, it'll begin to resonate in your body, mind, and heart. And as it resonates, it begins to turn up things that might be there for a long time back. Sometimes koans stir up things inside ourselves that we'd forgotten about or have tried to put away. And working through them is a matter of constantly coming back to that stable samadhi mind, that stable empty mind. And gradually the door inside ourselves opened and opens, and we have a glimpse of awakening. So this is sort of how koans work. So today's koan is very simple. Buffalo passes by the window, his head, horns, and forelegs all go past. Why can't the tail pass too? Now, in Chinese culture, there is Chinese architecture, there's a feature called a moon gate. Maybe some of you have seen it. They also have moon gates in Japan and Vietnam, and probably in Korea, though I don't know. And it's a gate in a wall, or in a building, usually in a wall, and it's round instead of square, so it's like a moon. And you can pass through this circle and go into a courtyard or go into another area. And so it's quite a beautiful fixture of architecture. And also it's a symbol. It does have a symbolic dimension. It's a circle. And a circle is a symbol of perfection. So in a way, this is talking about the experience of wholeness, or the experience of perfection, or the experience of completeness. Or you could say the experience of being awake, because all of those are characteristics of being awake. So the koan is saying something about being awake has an intellectual dimension, a symbolic dimension, but that's not the essence of the koan. Today is just a beautiful day, and I was just astounded as I was driving here. I passed by a little lake over in Piscataway. Maybe some of you also drive by that lake. And one of my co-workers actually has a house on that lake. It's quite a lovely place to live. And the lake today was like a mirror. It was just absolutely perfect. And all the clouds in the sky, in the early morning sky, were mirrored in the surface of the lake. It was just beautiful. And the sky itself is just breathtaking. So beautiful. And the temperature today is so beautiful. We've all come here today to sit, to do zazen. This is a holiday weekend, and you could be at the beach or you could be in the mountains, but you came here to practice Zen meditation. And, we sit on the cushion, and we're in a quest for perfection. We're in a quest for that wonderful experience we sometimes have where everything seems connected, alive, whole. And those are beautiful moments, beautiful moments. And so here we are sitting in pursuit of that. Now, at the same time, this is going on today. You know, you've probably been following in the newspapers all the terrible events in New Orleans. I don't know if you've ever been to New Orleans, but it's really quite a town. I've been there maybe four times in my life, and I just thought it was one of the most marvelous places I'd ever been to. So beautiful. My wife and I camped out on Lake Pontchartrain, where which you've probably heard about in the news. And by Lake Pontchartrain, there are these beautiful 200-year-old live oaks. I don't know if you know what a live oak is, but it's it's a kind of oak tree that stays green all year around. And these trees are so old, they're so huge, they don't grow tall, they grow wide. And their limbs go on for like 20 yards. It's unbelievable. They grow very wide. And they have limbs that sometimes go on for 10 yards, 20 yards. They get so long they go down to the ground and then they go back up. Very beautiful, strange, beautiful trees. And the whole country there is beautiful, and the city was beautiful. We've been reading the newspapers and listening on the news about all the terrible things happening in New Orleans the last 6 days. And I think it makes our practice here very poignant. You know, last night I actually got up at around 3 o'clock in the morning. I usually get up around 4:30. But I just couldn't sleep because I was thinking about this event in New Orleans. And, it bothered me. And I think it probably should. You know. We have, this is life, I think, you know. Here in New Jersey, the weather is really beautiful. And it's just gorgeous. This is some of the nicest weather. The last week has been some of the nicest weather we've had all year after a very hot and muggy summer. And we got up today and we came in to do zazen, and maybe some of you really entered deep samadhi and began to feel this sense of connection and wholeness. And that's just wonderful when it happens. At the same time, somebody's lying on the street in New Orleans, dying of renal failure or, crying. This is really like life, it's complicated. How do we keep going in something like this? What's the point of something like this, when it could all be taken away from us? Like that, right? Just like that. All those people, 2 weeks ago, all of those people in New Orleans were getting ready for a big festival. Not Mardi Gras, but they have another one, I think, in the fall. And it's such a beautiful place to live. And I'll never forget the first time my wife and I went there. Drove through, and we were just going to pass through, and it was such a cool place. We stayed there for like a week. And we didn't have much money, so we were eating at these cheap restaurants near the French Quarter. And it was like a paradise, because this is an area that was basically for rather poor people. And you could go to there was a restaurant called Buster's there. And you could go to Buster's, and for 75 cents, this was 30 years ago, for 75 cents, you could get a plate of red beans and rice. And man, was it good. You could for $1.25 you could get chicken and rice, and for like $2 you could get ham and rice. So I would go every day and have beans and rice, And they had free French bread on a big plate. And this is, I don't know if there's a, this company still in existence, but it was called Binder's Bread, if there is ever a New Orleans again. And you're ever in New Orleans, it's called Binder's Bread. And Binder's Bread was the best French bread I have ever had in my life. I mean, incredible. And they would just carve up big logs of this bread, you know, that's in baguettes. So they carve them up, and they just stack them up on a plate with a bunch of butter, so you could have all the beans and rice you wanted, and you could have all the Binder's Bread you wanted for 75 cents. So this was like paradise for two poor hippies, you know, on the road. And then, we went to a bakery and had a croissant. This was my first croissant. In fact, it was what's called an almond croissant. You know, I myself had never had a croissant. In fact, I didn't even know how to pronounce them. And we went in and asked for this thing we saw, which was and we ate it, and it was like, oh my God, you know, it's got almonds in it, you know. So that was like heaven. And we just had many adventures in that beautiful city. And every time I've gone back, I like to jog through the French Quarter, and they have beautiful graveyards and gardens, incredible garden section. And now it's gone. You know, it may never be back. And it was just instantaneous, like overnight. And now, you know, it's so distressing to see these events unfold, because, you know, fundamentally, people who could get out, people who were wealthy enough to get out, left. And then all the poor people are left in the city. And the social services, the whole network of services and support has broken completely. And even the federal government seems to be unable to respond. And, you know, we can get mad at the government. You know, I myself am a Democrat. So, you know, I'm not a fan of Mr. Bush. But you know, actually getting mad at Mr. Bush doesn't really solve the problem. It won't even solve the problem in New Orleans. But it won't solve the bigger problem. And there's an even bigger problem here, although the problem in New Orleans is truly terrible. And that is, you know, we all are spectators to an event which is a truly terrible event. And it's unfolding in ways we can't control. And people who I think are clearly innocent, you know, are just suffering unbelievably. And this is so much a part of our human life, is it not? I mean, this isn't the first time we've seen this. Yeah. I remember when I was about 17 years old, reading about President Nixon gave an order to a bomb. Laos and Cambodia. And I felt so helpless. I was just a kid, and I had no understanding of, you know, politics or anything. And I was just appalled that all of these innocent people were getting killed. And of course I demonstrated against Nixon and so on and so on. You know, again and again these events happen, and I think they have a subtle psychological effect. Obviously they have an effect on the people in New Orleans who are left behind. I mean, I think they feel deeply betrayed. And my personal impression of all this, and it's just my opinion, you know, if you've been watching TV, you've been seeing pictures of people stealing televisions. And everybody's been saying, you know, this looting is bad. And my feeling is it's very strange that people who no longer have a house and people who no longer have any electricity would steal a television. I don't think it's really about television. I think it's about anger. You know, my feeling is people are stealing TVs because they have a tremendous sense of betrayal or real sense that they, betrayal, I guess that's the word. I mean, maybe I'm liberal and so on, and I'm just a, but it doesn't make any sense for somebody to steal the TV when there's no electricity and you don't have a house to put it in anymore. You know, it just doesn't make sense. It's not, it's a different kind of act than that. You know, and I think it has to do with feeling that I've been abandoned by my world, and I'm angry about it. And I think that when we look in the newspaper or we watch TV and we see this, you know, it's it really has a deep psychological effect on us. Because, okay, we're in New Jersey, and it's safe, and it's beautiful right now. And it couldn't be nicer. But on another level, I think this has a profound resonance on many levels, because what we see is life dealing people this terrible blow. And no redress, no rescue coming, at least right now. And by the time it comes, it's going to be in some ways too late, you know. So I think this leaves a big hole in our trust in life. And I think it affects people's behavior on many levels. It's like, subtly and grossly, people begin to say, you know, you really can't trust life. You really can't trust life. And I think it will have, like waves. This is like an event where the waves go out and out and out, and they subtly affect many different things. I mean, one of the reasons I think people become so coarse and aggressive is because they feel they have to be in such a dangerous world or untrustworthy world. And they might never put it that way, but it's like the lesson of life is that this is a dangerous place and that nobody's going to help you. I even think, you know, when I was a young kid, when I was maybe 7 or 8, actually I was a little younger than that. I was probably, maybe 7, somewhere around there. I can't do the math right now, but I was a kid during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is before many of you were born. But the United States and the Soviet Union, after World War II, began to build a huge missile arsenal with nuclear warheads. And they engaged in a competition. And they built so many warheads that if either one of them had gone to war with the other, it would have obliterated the human race probably several times over. And yet they couldn't stop. They couldn't stop because of this pervasive distrust. And, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States had been allies during World War II, but right after the war they began to build up these weapons to protect one another. You know, Americans began to fear the Russians and build these incredibly deadly weapons, and Russians began to build these deadly weapons to protect against the United States. And it is true that, you know, they were communists and we were capitalists and so on. But I think that the behavior has much more to do, believe it or not, with the Holocaust. Because, I mean, there again, you know, all humans on Earth saw the spectacle of helpless people, really blameless people, suffering terribly and no rescue coming to them. You know. And this casts a spell, I think, on the human race. You know, it's like a spell. And I think it has wave effects that carry on through the generations. You know, and people lose faith in the goodness of life, and they lose faith in the potential of their fellow human beings to be good. You know. And so, you know, this is not the Holocaust, you know, what has happened here. But it's an event of some importance, yeah? Where maybe thousands of people are going to be dead, and you know, a million people might be homeless overnight, and a beautiful city might be destroyed. And you know, we don't have to look in the United States to see this going on all over the world. So you know, it's possible to say that when we do something like Zen practice, you know, we're wasting our time. You know, this is like pie in the sky. You know, why are you sitting here when there's suffering all over the world? But I think one of the curious things about our situation is that humans do so little to alleviate suffering. See? I mean, I think it's curious that people do so little to alleviate human suffering. You know, the fact is, you know, I read an article in National Geographic, five years ago, on New Orleans, the problem with New Orleans location. And this is a magazine that has a circulation of I don't know what, you know, 100,000, 200,000. And the article said, you know, interviewed scientists who all said, New Orleans is in big trouble. If we get a big hurricane, it could wipe us out. We've got to you know, do something to deal with this problem. And it was a complex problem, you know. First of all, the levee system is inadequate. The environmental degradation has removed the barriers of plant life and groves of mangrove trees and things like that that used to protect against these surges, these storm surges. Pumping water and oil has lowered the water table, all of this stuff. We've known this for half a decade. You know, and yet we didn't do anything. See, and I think that's fascinating. You know, this was also true during the Holocaust. People didn't do anything, really. And you have to say, or what's going on in Sudan right now? I think people get paralyzed, you know, by these events. I think they cast a kind of spell over people. And, you know, we tried to create islands of safety and happiness in a sea of precarious danger, you know, a sea of danger. You know, when the spell is cast over us, we really do, we don't maybe think I've lost my trust in life, but it adds up to different kind of attitude. And so, you know, we began to live a life that's sort of cautiously selfish. We're like pursuing selfish happiness for me and my friends and my family, and basically we sort of realize that it's dangerous, and you know, everybody's sort of got to fend for himself a little bit. And I actually think this is why we don't act. You know, it's too painful to look. You know, it's just too painful because it's like we want to live in the moon gate. Yeah, the moon gate is like, you know, you get up in the morning and you go outside and the birds are singing and it's a beautiful day and you have a cup of Blue Mountain, you know, coffee, and you have a bagel if you like bagels, or you have a, you know, Dunkin' Donuts if you like Dunkin' Donuts. You know, maybe listen to some music on your iPod, and you know it's a dangerous world out there. You're happy right now. And you know, why didn't we fix the dams in New Orleans? Why didn't, you know, it would have taken a kind of sacrifice. We would have had to sort of break the spell of our make some sacrifices. We would have had to face the fact that, you know, things are dangerous sometimes. You can't always count on the good luck and so on. I'm not being very clear, but I think these two things go together. I think, you know, we cling to happiness. We cling to security. And so we don't address these problems, you know. And I think these two things go together. It's like we see destruction, we see violence, we see injustice, and so we try to just be a little island of happiness and security. And then we can't change things because we can't face... You know, there are actually people who will say, I just don't want to read the papers. It's too depressing. It's too depressing. And I think that's very human. I don't think people who say that should be blamed. I actually know a number of people like that who are very tender-hearted people. You know, they're really sensitive people. In fact, when they start to read the papers, they get so depressed they have to stop. See? And I actually feel very much affection for people like that. You know, I think they're very, very good people. They're very tender-hearted. And it just is, it sort of grinds you down after a while if you pay too much attention. So how do you pay attention and not get ground down? Or how do you pay attention and not lose your faith in life? You know, and I think Zen practice is very directly related to that. I think that's what all this training is about. You know, it's about, you know, okay, you know, sometimes life is a moon gate. You know, sometimes life is beautiful and perfect. You know? But you have to be willing to look at the tail of the buffalo. You know, there's something that's not perfect. There's, you know, something, you know, being too hungry for perfection, too hungry for happiness, it shows a kind of radical or kind of deep-seated fear of life. See, deep-seated fear of life, deep-seated lack of trust. You know, there was a Zen master who loved his teacher. This was a Zen master who had studied with his teacher for many, many years. He became a very famous Zen master himself. And he had a deep personal relationship with his teacher. And when his teacher died, he was supposed to conduct the ceremony, the funeral ceremony for his teacher. And this was a very famous Zen master. And his teacher was very famous in China. And so all of these monks and nuns, all of these lay people, this community, big community, was assembled at this famous temple. And this Zen master came and he was going to do the eulogy. And he just started crying, you know, just started crying. And one of his students said, you know, you're crying, you're supposed to be a Zen master. What are you, you can't cry, you know. And the teacher said, listen, when I want to cry, I'm going to cry. You know, I think that shows great courage, right? That too shows great trust in life. You know, because if we cling too much to happiness, you know, we can't be helpful. There's a kind of deep distrust of life in clinging too much to happiness. You know, I hope I'm making some sense. You know, I don't want everybody to get out their hankies and weep now. You know, that's not what I'm saying. You know, and I'm not saying you owe it to the universe to be unhappy either. I know people like that. You know, who literally are unhappy all the time because they think they have a moral duty to be unhappy. That's not quite what this koan is getting at. You know, there's a deeper wholeness to things, which is I believe that if you practice long enough, you will discover that there is a deeper wholeness to things, even though they fall apart like this. You know, even though they fall apart, there's a deeper wholeness to life. And it's bigger than these calamities. And the calamities are so big, you know, that this has to be really big wholeness. And if we don't face the troubles, we don't face our troubles, whatever they might be, you know, and we want to hold on to happiness, we can't encounter that really big wholeness. You know, the Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, I remember reading an essay he wrote about watching his village destroyed by napalm. If I'm not misremembering this, he was asked to talk about 9/11. and what a terrible tragedy 9/11 was. And at that time, all people in America were wringing their hands about what victims we were. And indeed, we were victims. But everywhere people were going, they were talking about, you know, this is so terrible, we were blameless, you know, how did... And he talked about seeing his village destroyed by napalm. You know, part of what he was saying is that nobody's totally blameless, right? I mean, that's part of what he was saying. But also part of what he was saying is that, you know, it's not good enough just to say this is an injustice or we've been injured, or you have to look for the deeper wholeness. You know, and the way to find the deeper wholeness is through the things that trouble us, that keep us awake at night, and that that may cause us some difficulty and discomfort. I mean, a lot of people here in this room already understand this very well. You know, I know that some of you are deeply engaged with, you know, helping people who need help. You know, so I just think it's an important point to make. You know, that we can't cling too much. Don't owe it to the universe to be unhappy. The point of this is happiness. But happiness is not real unless it can embrace everything, you know, even the calamities. And this is really quite important. When I was, last night, when I was lying in bed, I just had these images running through my mind of, you know, these events that I saw on television. I had gone to bed, and then I woke up, and there they were in my mind. And I have to tell you, I was troubled. So I got up and I did some zazen, you know. And, you know, this is the way you work through any koan. This is like a real-life koan, in my opinion. You know, it bothers you, and really there's nothing intellectually that can be said, right? I mean, you could say, oh, it's all George Bush's fault. You know, that Bush, this just shows he's a bum, you know. And I don't think that gets, first of all, I didn't vote for the man, okay? And I won't vote for his brother when his brother runs in 2 years or something. But it doesn't really get us anywhere to do that, in my opinion, you know. Because that doesn't solve the bigger problem, which is that life has seems to have betrayed us. You know. So I don't think there's anything you can say intellectually. You can't say, well, we should have invested more. You know, it doesn't really help. We should have invested more money in the levees. This is just the problem of short-sightedness. We need to reinvest in the public sphere. Yes, those are all true. But it doesn't really take away that pain, does it? Or that sense of, you're troubled. Your heart is troubled, right? There's nothing intellectually that's going to solve this now. You know, it would be, you know, one should, you know, make a donation to the Red Cross, pressure legislators to, you know, those things have to be done. But even that doesn't really doesn't take it all away, does it? You know. So you sit on the cushion, and. You have to enter deep samadhi, deep mushin, you know, and you see that pain, you know, you feel that pain, and it's your pain, you know, it's not the pain of people in New Orleans. You're pained by their unhappiness because it's such a betrayal of, you know, life seems to be so dangerous, untrustworthy, what a terrible world, you know, etc. And it troubles you. But it's very important, I think, to deal with that, you know, deal with that. And so, you know, what I did, this might not be a satisfactory solution to everybody, but, you know, I did what has worked for me in the past. You know, I sit down on the cushion and I watch my breath and I enter deep machine and I see that pain, you know. It's anger, pain, disappointment. You know, I have a part of me that wants to blame Mr. Bush. I have a part of me that's really ticked off at the, you know, Homeland Security, whoever I want to blame. You know, I'm mad in general. There's like a general feeling of being angry about this, as well as troubled, you know. And you come back to your breath, and you come back to Mu, and you the pain, little by little, it goes away. And there's just like a, it's like a switch. You know, I mean, that pain, I think we all feel, you know. You lose your job, it just hurts, right? You know, life hurts you. And you can say, well, you'll get another job, 5 years from now you'll laugh, you know. You're not laughing then, you know, and it hurts right down to your molecules, right? You know, it hurts your body, it hurts your heart, you feel like your heart is breaking. I've lost a few jobs, I have to tell you. You know, I wanted this job when I got through graduate school at Pomona College in California. It's in a beautiful place. The job was tailor-made for me. I just thought, well, I'm going to get this job. This was written for me, you know. And it was, the job was given to somebody who had like 3 books, you know, and I had nothing. I was just out of graduate school. But I had such high hopes, foolishly. And I went to the interview and I actually came back and said to my wife, I think it's in the bag. It's like, I should have known, right? I was tempting the fates, right? Because I think it's in the bag, you know. That interview went beautifully, you know. Well, let's pack our bags. We're going to Pomona, California. And we didn't get it, even my wife cried. She was so unhappy. She was more unhappy than I was, you know. Because she didn't like Seattle, I have to tell you. It was too cloudy, you know. We were going to California. I think she thought she was going to escape. So, but it hurt me so badly because it made me feel like, you know, I was no good, et cetera, et cetera. And I just sat on the cushion, and I just sat and I sat until it's like a switch goes on in your body, and you're suddenly okay. It's like that feeling of well-being comes back, you know? And when that happens, you know, it's just magical. It's like this beautiful, I love this life, you know? Now, it would be a lot harder for me if I were in New Orleans, right? You know, it's easy for me sitting in my house in New Jersey feeling sorry for these people. But, you know, if I were in New Orleans, I'd have to do a lot more zazen, you know. But you know, we all have things that hurt us very badly, you know. This is the path, you know, I believe. You know, you have to, you know, you work through the thing that hurts you, the thing that betrays your trust or that does you an injury. You know, very important. That injury is the door to awakening. You know, I had my Daikensho experience at a time when everything was going to pieces. You know, it was in my life. First of all, I had gone out on the job market trying to get a job. And if you're in English, there aren't that many jobs. I mean, the chances of you getting a job are like 1 in 400 at that time. They were about 1 in 400. So you send out 400 letters and you might get a job. You know, it's that bad. So I had gone out on the job market and nothing after, you know, working for 7 years on my PhD. At the same time, in our Zen community, the two teachers, we had two teachers, two people I love very deeply, basically decided they wanted to, they had a conflict. You might think enlightened people don't have any conflicts with each other, but they're still human beings and they still have defects. Very important thing to remember. Genki Roshi was deeply awake, but he had human failings, just like anybody else. And Webb Sensei was deeply awake, but had human failings just like anybody else. And astonishing to me that two people who were so deeply awake could actually be petty, you know? Petty and childish, I thought. And this rocked my world, let me tell you, because these people walked on water for me, right? They walked on water. I mean, I had seen Genki Roshi, he was the most compassionate, kindly, supportive person I'd ever known. Webb was the same way. So suddenly these two people are at each other's throats almost. And that was astounding. And you could imagine how that affected our whole community. It was like a bomb went off in our Zen community. Because these are enlightened people. They're behaving in petty ways. They're not behaving like enlightened people. And it didn't add up to, it didn't confirm our opinion of these people. It's like, this is not making sense, right? So this plunged people into doubts about the whole enterprise of doing Zen practice. Right? It's like, maybe this is all a fraud, you know? Now, at the same time, everybody was going through this crisis of faith in this practice. We had taken out a very large mortgage to pay for our temple. And guess who was treasurer? I was. And I'm an English person. I'm not an accounting person, right? And I had some friends who helped me with this who were accounting types or business types. But I was the one who was supposed to be writing the checks and presiding. And basically, we began to develop this huge cash flow problem that ultimately led to the sale of our temple, believe it or not, which is something I had to preside over too. And so, you know, we had a cash flow problem because all of these people suddenly had doubts about Zen and about their teachers, and they just stopped sending in those checks every week. So, basically, I was going to be unemployed. This community that I loved more than anything in the world was falling apart. And the temple I had helped to build, you know, I put the windows in, you know, I put the flooring in. You know, and that we had all worked together to build was now going to be put on the auction block, right? And it was. So this was like the end of the world for me, you know. And So, Genki left for a while, left Seattle, basically, for a month, I think, and went to Japan, went back to Ryotakuji. And Webb went ahead and held the Sesshin. And we used to get about 40 people at Sesshin, but I think like 6 people came to Sesshin. And I myself wasn't going to go to Sesshin because I was so bummed out by the whole thing. And Webb asked me if I was going to go to Sesshin, and I looked at his face, and I just couldn't bear to say no. You know, I just thought, I just didn't want to hurt him. Because I actually didn't want to take sides in this. I love Genki, and I love Webb. I did, and I do. You know, but I looked at Webb's face, and I really just couldn't bear to say no. So I said, "Oh yes, I'm going to Sesshin," and I all the way up to Tokuganji, where our temple, which we were going to sell, and we were having our last Sesshin. I kept thinking, "Why am I doing this? You know, I really want to just get out. I never want to see any of this again. You know, this has just been such a bummer for me." And I sat on the we sat in Sesshin. And then the strangest thing happened because, it wasn't really strange, but it seemed strange at the time. A bird came into the Zendo. We had just put windows in, and we had a door, big front door into the temple, big, beautiful door. And we opened those doors up. There was no screen or anything, so, you know, bugs could fly in. And a mountain blue jay came in, into the Zendo. And so animals would come in sometimes, squirrels, and they would hop around while we were sitting. And it was great, you know, these little squirrels, you hear plip-pitty-plip-pitty-plip, you know. And but a mountain blue jay came in, and it landed in the Zendo, and then it tried to get out, and it didn't understand the windows. This is very common. If you know birds, they don't understand glass. So it hit the glass and fell down. And when we had our break, I went and found it. We didn't sit on the floor, we sat on what are called tans. They're elevated platforms, and you store your gear under the platform, and the cushions are on top of the platform. The bird was in there, and basically it had broken its legs. You know, so this was like the last straw for me. You know, I have a great love of birds, of course, as you know. And so I tried to feed this little bird, you know, and I didn't know what it ate. You know, does it eat seeds? So I got some seeds, I got some worms, I got some bread, and I put it, you know, it was under the zendo, under these tons, and anyway, you know, we went to sleep, and the next day I came back, and some animal had come in and eaten the bird. And that was it for me, you know, and that was when I had my Daikensho experience, because it just hurt so much. But it was that experience, you know, that made it possible to, you know, I was basically kind of a hard-hearted person, you know, very small-minded, and I guess that's what it took, you know, all of those calamities in a row. But it was just that blew the doors off my life. You know, so there's something very important about this, you know, that it's not wrong to want to be happy. That you don't owe it to the universe to be suffering all the time. Buddha actually talks about happiness all the time. And he says that if you clear away obstructions, you know, you're going to feel absolute joy. And he says happiness is the path leads to happiness. But, you know, the Buddha himself, his whole family were the victims of a genocide. That happened in his life, not, you know, not an idiot. You know, he understood how life really is. You know, his family lived in a place which was called the Shakya Republic. And the whole Shakya tribe, you could say, they were like an extended group of people, like a clan, like a Scottish clan. The whole Shakya tribe was annihilated in the Buddha's time. And still talking about cultivating the mind of trust, the mind of joy, you know, infinite trust. So this is what it's all about. You know, this is life. This is where we do our practice. You know, if you cling to bliss, you don't wake up. If you cling to happiness, you don't wake up. If you cling to misery, you don't wake up. You know, this is like life, right? You know, this is like life. Today we sit on the cushion, we enter deep samadhi, we call Mu. You know, over in the distance is rumbling thunder, yes? And that rumbling thunder could bring, you know, suffering and pain to all of us. It's a voice we have to hear in order to wake up. So the happiness is... Buddha said his path is beautiful at the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful at the end. You know, joy, joy, joy. You know, but in the midst, joy takes root in the midst of all this suffering. And the condition for awakening is our engagement with this world. Gozo said, a buffalo passes by the window. His head, horns, and four legs all go past. Why can't the tail pass too? See, why does there always have to be a tail? You know, I was so happy and I lost my job. You know, I was so happy and the phone call came and the doctor said I have cancer. You know, I was so, you know. Why has there always got to be a tail to this damn world? See, everything's nice except New Orleans. Ah, you know, damn it. Now, don't look away. Mumon's comment. If you make a complete about face, open your eye, and give a turning word on this point, you will be able to repay the four kinds of love that have favored you and help the sentient beings in the three realms that follow you. If you are still unable to do this, return to this tale and reflect upon it. And then, for the first time, you may realize something. Mulan's verse, passing by, it falls into a ditch. Coming back, all the worst, it's lost. This tiny little tale, what a strange thing it is.